program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Audio Journal's reading of Psychology Today. This broadcast is for informational purposes only, and suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. This is Tracy, and today I'll start with an article under the category of happiness. This is by Ira Bedzau, and it's titled The Importance of an Ordinary Day. Life is lived mostly in ordinary moments, not in major achievements. Key points. We chase success as outcomes, but overlook how we actually spend our days. Flourishing comes from aligning daily actions with values, not achievements. When students or professionals sit down across from me for what I call a flourishing chat, which is a mix between life, professional, and health coaching, they rarely begin with a crisis. More often, they say something like, I know what I want to do, I just don't feel that great about it. They describe futures that sound impressive, consulting, medicine, law, leadership roles at major companies. The plans are polished, the resumes are strong. From the outside, everything looks ready to go. Then I ask a different question. What would your ordinary Tuesday look like at this job? I don't want to know about the title on their business cards or their starting salary. I want them to tell me what time they'll wake up, who they will spend their days with, what kinds of problems they will solve, what their evenings feel like when they come home tired. At this point in the conversation, every time students and sometimes even professionals can't answer my questions, the conversation turns into silence. They've thought about what role they want, but they haven't yet thought about what the role entails or how it fits with the activities they like to do and the people they care about. We are taught early to think of success as a possession. We accumulate credentials, milestones, promotions, and recognition. We pursue outcomes that can be measured and displayed. Yet even if we mark our life journey with milestones, most of our time traveling will be in the everyday steps we take along our way. How we travel will not only determine which path we take, it will also determine which milestones are worth marking. The philosopher Aristotle distinguished between external goods, wealth, status, honor, and what he called eudaimonia, which is what today we call flourishing or living a good life, rooted in activity rather than possession. Flourishing isn't something you own. It's something you do consistently and as a way that speaks to your gifts and identity. It's a way of living that aligns one's actions with one's character and in accord with their values. When I talk about this type of flourishing, most people agree that it sounds nice in theory. Yet when it comes to making personal and professional decisions about their lives, they often revert to their old habits of choosing the path that looks most successful from the outside, rather than one they can get excited about actually living day to day. I see this tension regularly with students who feel pulled toward careers they are not sure they will enjoy. But I also see it with professionals at almost every stage of their career. Ambition is framed as climbing a ladder rather than finding better ways to act on one's values so that you can have a greater impact on oneself and others. Success is an external metric rather than an internal measure of alignment. This isn't anyone's fault. Our culture reinforces the idea that success happens at the finish line. Social media compresses lives into highlight reels. The graduation photo, the new job announcement, the promotion. We see the trophies, not the ordinary weekday mornings that make up a life. Life is mostly weekdays. I learned this lesson myself early in my career. Like many ambitious young professionals, I believed that hard work meant sacrificing the present so that future happiness could eventually arrive. Like the lesson of the famous marshmallow test, I thought it demonstrated the capacity to achieve success, a noble ability to endure now so I can enjoy later. While endurance is an important ability, and it is important to put in the time to become great at what we do, it's equally important to consider what we are enduring for. Is it to achieve for the sake of achievement? Or is it to be able to successfully accomplish the things we truly care about doing? Psychologists sometimes talk about the arrival fallacy, which is the belief that reaching a certain goal will bring lasting fulfillment. The problem is that achieving these goals rarely transforms daily life in the ways we expect. We adapt quickly. We keep running on that hedonic treadmill. New pressures replace old ones. The future we imagine becomes simply the new normal. Meanwhile, the real question remains unanswered. Do I actually like how I spend my days? This is why, in these flourishing chats, I push my conversation partners toward the details, towards painting as complete a picture as they can. Not because I want to discourage ambition, but because ambition is healthier when it is grounded in reality and in self-reflection. What are you doing from 9 to 5? Who are you talking to? What parts of the work energize you and what parts drain you? These questions shift the frame. They ask us to stop seeing success as something you possess and to start seeing it as something you practice. They ask us to pay attention to the details of how we live our days. This perspective doesn't make decisions easier. In fact, it can make them harder because we now have to think beyond external validation and ask ourselves what actually sustains us. We must be honest about trade-offs we are willing to make and have the courage to choose paths that may not look impressive from other people's vantage points. Yet, taking this view of success also offers something liberating, because now our everyday isn't a means to a few momentary milestones. Life is embraced through the ordinary days we spend living it. This next article is by Lauren Soero, PhD. It's titled, 5 Manipulation Tactics You Might Not See Until It's Too Late. Recognizing these manipulation tricks can help you reestablish your boundaries. Key points. Gaslighting makes you doubt your sense of reality, and guilt tripping turns vulnerabilities into leverage. Moving the goalposts keeps you striving toward a standard you can never reach. Triangulation isolates you by recruiting others to undermine your credibility. If you've ever wondered if there's something not quite genuine about your romantic relationship, as if your partner seems to be trying to bring out specific reactions or certain feelings in you, you might be experiencing an insidious form of psychological manipulation. Perhaps you're apologizing a lot more than usual, even though you're not sure what you did wrong. Or maybe they keep telling you something about your behavior needs to change, although you've never heard that suggestion from anyone else. It's easy to feel confused when a person you care about seems to be quietly controlling you, intentionally creating fear, guilt, or uncertainty to get what they want at your expense. They may even possess the dark triad of personality traits, narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism, which characterize the people who most often manipulate others, according to Jones and Paulhus in 2014. The 5 tactics these manipulators use most often can easily fly under the radar until you've lost your emotional bearings. Tactic 1, gaslighting. No, you're remembering it wrong. It was only a joke. You're too sensitive. That's not what happened. You're way off base. When you hear phrases like these frequently enough, you can start to doubt yourself. Your partner cares about you, right? They wouldn't steer you wrong. But gaslighting remarks like this can make almost anyone start questioning their own memory and sense of objective truth. Gaslighting is one of the main manipulative strategies used by Machiavellian personalities, that is, those oriented toward power and control, and often money, rather than toward the well-being of others, according to Kumar and Malvia in 2025. Cold, calculating Machiavellians, no matter how charming or attractive they seem, will prioritize deception and control when they get close to someone. Getting in too deep with a person like this can make you feel like your familiar sense of self has dropped out from beneath you. Tactic 2, love bombing, then pulling back. In the early days of a relationship, when your new partner takes especially good care of you, with thoughtful gifts, meaningful talks, a lot of time together, and maybe some hints about a real future, you can be forgiven for failing to wonder if it's too good to be true. Intimacy that develops quickly can feel too good to question, but when it's followed by a sudden disappearance or a change in tone, you'll probably feel a flicker of doubt. And just as you're about to take action to protect yourself, there's your partner again, offering another loving late-night talk and some vague plans for a weekend away. This is called intermittent reinforcement, and it works like a slot machine, which pays out its winnings at unpredictable intervals, making it hard for you to walk away. Studies of people with manipulative personalities point out that they strategically use charm and appreciation to secure commitment or advantage, then withdraw once they win you over again, according to Brewer and Abel in 2015. Tactic 3, guilt. This one is crucial. When a manipulator learns how to press your guilt button, they'll always be able to turn a conflict to their advantage. You abandoned me, they might say, or you're never grateful. Even if they're the one to cause a problem between you, somehow it will point to one of your flaws. Perhaps you've talked about something private, like the pain of a disruption in your family. People like this might make a good show of empathy at first, then mention it again at the worst possible moment as a hit below the belt. Right now, you're acting just like your stepdad. This could lead you to make significant concessions, to ignore your limits, or to give in to your partner, even when you don't want to. It's another tactic that's found in personality research on the Machiavellian style in Jones and Paulhus 2009, where it's described as creating emotional leverage. Tactic 4, moving the goalposts. Decades ago, psychology researchers spotted this strategy, the use of withdrawal or criticism to control behavior, according to Buss and others in 1987. It happens when your partner is perfectly clear about their expectations at first, but changes them as time goes by. Maybe they want you to dress a certain way, or sample a particular substance you're unsure about, or reveal some intimate information. They may plead and plead, promising affection and seeming sincere enough, until ultimately you give in. But the happy relief you'll feel will be short-lived, as there's no making this person happy. As soon as you give them what they want, it'll turn out to be less than enough. What they were desperate for last week now seems like the bare minimum, as though any implicit agreement has been altered after the fact. When this defines your relationship, you'll get that walking on eggshells feeling, and the chronic sense of trying to live up to a vaguely defined standard you can never reach, which may render you easier to control. Tactic 5, triangulation. Jones and Paulhus in 2009 also pointed out that the underhanded use of a third person can be used to gain relational power and influence, or to exert pressure in the case of a disagreement. "They all think you're too loud," you might be told, or, "I asked a lot of people about your opinion on this. No one understands what you mean." Are these statements true or just part of a tactic? It's even worse when they go directly behind your back, to your coworkers, friends, or even family, in an effort to build support or to paint you in a negative light. The intention is to isolate you from people who might take your side, while at the same time gaining undeserved sympathy because of the things they claim you've done or said. Manipulators do this because they care more about looking good and maintaining a sense of control than making a genuine effort to resolve a problem. If reading through this list gives you a sinking feeling because you recognize these patterns from your own life, take heart. There are things you can do. First, get a reality check. Write down what was said to you. Then talk it through in private with a trusted friend or therapist who's familiar with the situation but not directly involved. Identify the tactic being used against you. Is it a guilt trip? A triangulation? Recognizing that these phenomena are classic, well-worn manipulation strategies identified years ago in social science research can help ground you. At that point, try to set small boundaries, as in, "I don't think I want to do that right now," or, "I'm not comfortable with that. Let's talk about it later." To take back some agency and also to see how your partner responds. If things don't go well from there, you'll have more evidence that something is wrong. Lastly, if you feel that the pattern of manipulation has become serious, to the point of emotional or even physical abuse, don't wait. Look for real help, professional or otherwise, as soon as possible. Noticing and labeling the manipulation means you've recognized that the situation no longer works for you and that you deserve better treatment. This next article is by Azadeh Alai. It's titled, "The Landmark Verdict Against Social Media Got It Right." Will a verdict on social media addiction finally rein in big tech? This past Monday, I had the opportunity at the annual ASPA conference in California to speak on a panel about teaching mass atrocity prevention to public service professionals. Much of what I spoke on is based on my recently published book, Disconnection: The Search for Identity in a Digital Age, 2026. In particular, I was focusing on the role social media platforms and, more generally, digital culture are playing as pipelines for radicalization processes that contribute to mass violence and atrocities, including genocide. One of the most prominent preventive strategies I had to offer was quite simply, we need to get young people offline. We need to start community building and offering alternative socialization opportunities for our youth in in-person shared spaces. How resonant that the same week of this panel discussion, a jury in California found both Meta and YouTube, owned by Google, liable for a teen's mental health distress. Hailed as a landmark case against big tech, the implications of this recent ruling will hopefully reverberate across the industry. Specifically, the plaintiff in this case was alleging that both tech companies designed their platforms to be addictive, specifically targeting teens with their products and services. As reported by PBS, the plaintiff's lawyers pointed to specific design features they said were designed to hook young users, like the infinite nature of feeds that allowed for an endless supply of content, autoplay features, and even notifications, according to Ortute in 2026. The jury appeared to agree. as the plaintiff was awarded millions. Moreover, the jury had been explicitly instructed that the mental health struggles the plaintiff reported need not have been proven as caused by these platforms, but that rather they had to have served as substantial factors in contributing to her harm. Indeed, in addition to documenting many mental health harms that are implicated for young users who frequently engage with social media platforms, I dedicate a chapter of my book to their addictive design. I make this argument despite the fact that the current diagnostic manual in our field has not yet recognized internet or social media use as having the potential to trigger addictive behaviors, according to Alai in 2026. Scholars have been attempting to sound the alarm on the detrimental impact of social media to the health and well-being of young users, despite the fact that technological innovations generally outpace the amount of time it takes us to conduct research on impact to users. There are also far-ranging implications for democratic institutions, as communication and access to information have largely been mediated by the tech industry, and mis- and disinformation are running rampant. This is one of the many features of social media platforms that leave users vulnerable to radicalization and extremism, which can contribute to mass violence and atrocities. Perhaps the finding in this landmark case will be part of a growing trend of holding big tech accountable for the products they have released to the masses. Moreover, it is wildly unrealistic and untenable to place the burden solely on parents to monitor how their children engage with these platforms. Here is hoping research in our field will be used to further generate the political will to impose stronger regulations and guardrails to protect users from the damaging features of these platforms. Until then, I advise potential users to opt out of social media use as a protective measure for one's mental health, as well as a form of resistance against their predatory practices. This next article is by Suzanne Phillips. It's titled, Fiction is Indispensable to Life's Journey. We need and use fiction to deal with facts and feelings. Key points. Fiction offers us the places and people we need in our lives. Fiction vicariously gives us an escape from where we are. Fiction has the potential to make a complex and at times difficult world easier to be in. We never grow tired of loving and needing the fiction we find in books and movies. As children, we beg for one more book before we give over to sleep or ask to hear the favorite over and over again. As adults, we continue to trade in sleep to finish the chapter, see the end of the show, binge watch the series, or rewatch favorites on a host of devices. Why? We love fiction and we need fiction. We learn from fiction. We upload our imaginations to access fiction. We feel our way through fiction. We connect and we find ourselves and others through fiction. It expands our social cognition and understanding of the feelings and situations of others. According to Rezend and Shigafe in 2023. Why do we hold on to fiction in a way we never remember facts? Fiction transports us. Psychologists Melanie Green and Tim Brock, in their Transportation Imagery Model of 2013, suggest that we are transported by stories. We suspend vigilance to inaccuracies, reason, time, and place. Narrative persuasion, belief change, occurs to the extent that the evoked images are activated by psychological transportation to a state in which a reader becomes absorbed in the narrative world, for a time leaving the real world behind. We are moved emotionally and neurophysiologically, It's not a matter of ignoring the false notes. We don't even see them. Green and Brock argue that entering fictional worlds radically alters the way information is processed. The more absorbed readers are in a story, the more the story changes them. They propose that when we are highly absorbed in the story, we barely detect the false notes or inaccuracies. It is not a matter of ignoring the false notes. We don't even see them. Fiction connects us. Whether it is the story you are reading to your child or the movie you are watching with hundreds of others in the theater, the experience of laughing, screaming, or crying together connects us to others. Even if we watch separately, the fiction in books and films become part of our shared experiences. Movie titles, characters, and dialogue evoke certain meanings, become part of the shared culture, and are used in our daily lives long after a film is seen. We know what it means to say or hear someone say, "May the Force be with you," Star Wars, 1977. "Toto, I've a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore," The Wizard of Oz, 1939. "I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse," The Godfather, 1972. "You had me at hello," Jerry Maguire, 1996. Fiction enhances empathy and feelings. Fiction triggers empathy emotionally and by stimulating our neurochemistry through mirror neurons. When we are driving a race car, neurons in our brain fire. When we watch James Bond drive a race car, a subset of those same neurons also fire, giving us the virtual reality experience of driving. In terms of emotional or affective experience, if someone wounds me or steals my child, a set of neurons, anterior cingulate neurons, register pain and anguish in my brain. If you witness my pain, a subset of mirror neurons will fire in your brain, putting you in empathy with me by registering the emotional pain I'm suffering. As such, fiction invites us to see and experience the world through other people's eyes. There is a reason that Bambi is one of the most upsetting Disney movies. Fiction validates life experiences. Fiction allows us to know we are not alone in our feelings and thoughts. Many have embraced the reality that they are not the only one in a dysfunctional family, thanks to series like Shrinking and films like Home for the Holidays and Little Miss Sunshine. Yes, many members of many families have said to each other in public, "Try to act normal." Fiction offers escape. Fiction fulfills the request, "Stop the world, I want to get off." It allows us to escape from our world to worlds of fantasy and magical thinking. In Harry Potter, The Wizard of Oz, The Lord of the Rings, and Star Wars, we enter worlds of shared imagination that are very different and far from our day-to-day lives. Fiction allows justice to prevail. Many films and books provide the justice and moral reckoning we crave but can't guarantee in life. We believed in the decision reached in 12 Angry Men. We never tire of police shows that solve the case. We embrace Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, because we need it. Too many days in our lives feel like a Mission Impossible. We've needed James Bond, codenamed 007, since he arrived in the 1953 novel Casino Royale by Ian Fleming. Fiction inspires. We're moved to be all that we can be by films like Rocky, The Shawshank Redemption, Schindler's List, and A Beautiful Mind. We are inspired by the mix of love, friendship, and mortality shared in the words and pictures of children's books like Charlotte's Web in 1952. Fiction facilitates healing. Fiction allows us to revisit unspeakable and traumatic events at a distance. It interrupts the code of silence and the symptom of avoidance so common to post-traumatic stress disorder. It allows safe, small, visual and emotional steps to re-experience, find the words and integrate the unthinkable, tragic death, child abuse, war, etc. Films like Saving Private Ryan, The Deer Hunter, and Sound of Freedom evoke feelings and bear witness in important ways. Fiction takes us into the experiences, feelings, and thoughts of people we fear or don't know. A number of fictional shows have helped shape attitudes about gender, racism, and diversity. Vazali, Stahi, and others report that the greatest magic of the Harry Potter books was reducing prejudice. They found that reading the books improved attitudes towards stigmatized groups like immigrants, homosexuals, refugees, in elementary school children, as well as high school and university students in Italy and the United Kingdom. Similarly, films like 12 Years a Slave, The Help, and Remember the Titans raise consciousness about the horrors of slavery and racism and offer a glimpse of hope in the actions of young people using sports to connect. Fiction addresses our fear of death and destruction. These days, we spend a lot of time in fictional post-apocalyptic neighborhoods dealing with The Walking Dead and other threats. One hypothesis is that this is actually a counterphobic solution to what terrifies us, death. We are so anxious about death, we can't stop dealing with it, denying it, rounding up other survivors, or watching it in fiction. There's a story for everyone because we are part of the stories we need and love. Tell me the facts and I'll learn. Tell me the truth and I'll believe. But tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever, is a Native American proverb. This next article is by Jay Watts. It's titled, How Complex PTSD Fuels Limerence. Limerence and complex PTSD, when the past sends someone to find you. Key points. Limerence is not a crush or love. It's a state of involuntary, total preoccupation with another person. In CPTSD, limerence reactivates early attachment patterns rather than responding to the present relationship. Limerence runs on uncertainty, not warmth. The shame of watching ourselves obsess is itself part of the trauma, not evidence of a character flaw. Maya is not sleeping. She is also, quietly, going mad. Not at him, or not only at him. At the inadequacy of every word available to her. She's tried crush. She's tried falling in love. Her friends offer both back to her gently, and she wants to overturn the table. Neither fits. Both feel like being handed a thimble when what she needs is something that can hold an ocean. Because this isn't a feeling she's having. It's a state she's living in. Everything becomes a tunnel back to him. A song. A word someone says in a meeting. She changes the song. The next one does it too. She is not thinking about him again. She never stopped. And when a single message from him arrives, or doesn't, it reorganizes her entire day. She was right that it was something else, something that deserved its own name. Psychologists call it limerence, the involuntary, intrusive state of being entirely colonized by another person. Not infatuation, not love, though it can wear their clothes. Something more total and less chosen. And for those of us who carry complex trauma, it can arrive with a particular ferocity, surviving all rational challenge, making us feel like a stranger to ourselves. Limerence at this pitch is rarely random. It tends to find the people it finds for a reason. Complex PTSD. Complex PTSD develops not from a single traumatic event, but from prolonged, repeated harm, often in childhood, often within the relationships that were supposed to provide safety. Unlike single incident PTSD, it reaches into the architecture of the self. Identity becomes unstable, self-worth chronically eroded, emotional flashbacks more frequent than visual ones. It leaves particular marks on the capacity to feel solid, continuous, real, which is precisely why a limerent object can feel so organizing. So much like rescue, the nervous system that learned to scan constantly for shifts in a caregiver's mood is exquisitely, devastatingly well-trained for the uncertainty engine limerence runs on. The uncertainty engine. Limerence does not run on warmth. It runs on uncertainty. This is a thing most accounts miss. A person who is consistently kind, consistently present, consistently available does not, as a rule, produce limerence. What produces it is the intermittent signal, warm, then distant, then warm again. This creates a biological trap. When the signal is unpredictable, the brain's reward system spikes with dopamine during the warm phases. Because the reward is inconsistent, the psyche becomes hyper-focused on the next hit, creating a physiological need for the person. The interaction that felt electric, followed by the silence that could mean anything, is not just a feeling. It's a variable reinforcement schedule that the brain cannot easily quit. For those of us whose earliest attachment figures were unpredictable, present then gone, loving then cold, safe then frightening, this pattern and the attachment hunger it produces is not new. It is, in the most precise sense, familiar. The limerent object is running a program the psyche already knows. The hypervigilance, the scanning for signs, the desperate attempt to read the temperature of the room. We have done all of this before, much earlier, with much higher stakes. Limerence, in this light, is not a mystery. It's a recognition. We are not in the present. What Maya is in a relationship with is not this man. It is an internal figure, assembled, without her knowledge, from much older materials. The limerent object arrives and something recognizes them, though we have barely met. What we are recognizing is not them. It is the shape of an old longing that has finally found a face. This is why insight doesn't touch it. We can know that the feeling is disproportionate. We can see the projection. Knowledge sits in one layer while the longing runs in another, immune to reason. The person in front of us has become a screen for something much older. The hunger for attunement that didn't come. The safety that was never quite reliable. We are not waiting for them exactly. We are waiting for something they briefly seem to promise. And some part of us keeps waiting past all evidence because that is what it learned to do. That question tends to open slowly in work that takes the internal world seriously, often in therapy, where these patterns can be seen and worked with rather than acted out. Not just the facts of what happened, but the figures formed by it. The ones who are still there, still vivid, still pulling, sending emissaries into the present, looking for what they never got. The shame of watching ourselves. There is the longing, and then there is the shame about the longing. We check the phone, check again, replay the last exchange, looking for signs of warmth, of cooling, of where we stand. It can feel impossible to focus on anything else. We compose and delete. We watch ourselves doing it and cannot stop. In the gap between knowing and stopping lives a particular self-contempt. The feeling that this proves something, that we're too much, that no one could see inside this would want to stay. That shame is not an accurate reading of character. It's an old voice from an environment that taught us that needing was dangerous, that wanting too much drove people away. The limerence triggers it. The shame intensifies the limerence, because shame is also a wound that aches for repair, and the only repair on offer seems to be them. Maya describes it as being trapped in a room she built herself. She can see the walls. She cannot find the door. Not a disorder, but an unfinished story. Limerence is not evidence that something's wrong with us. It's evidence that something was interrupted, and that the psyche, with its own ferocious logic, is still trying to complete it. The limerent object is not a random fixation. They are a casting call answered by whoever carries the right resemblance to an older figure, someone who once held or withheld something essential. The obsession is not about them. It never quite was. The question that eventually becomes possible to ask, not in the flood of it, but standing briefly on dry ground, is not how do we stop feeling this, but what is this feeling trying to reach? What would actually satisfy it if a person, this person, any person, cannot? And how, even by a millimeter at first, we might begin to de-pedestal them, to return them to their actual dimensions rather than the dimensions the longing requires. What becomes possible over time is not the disappearance of longing. It is longing that knows what it actually is. That can be felt without the full catastrophe of the loop. That begins slowly to find the difference between the person in front of us and the one from long ago they were briefly, powerfully mistaken for. This next article is by Marianne Brandon. It's about artificial intelligence. What happens when we depend on AI instead of each other? It can be scary to depend on other people, but relying on AI may not be the answer. Key points. AI chatbots are programmed to fill many roles simultaneously, more than any human partner ever could. Some people who resist depending on others have rapidly grown dependent on AI with no apparent resistance. When we offload skills to AI, whether cognitive or emotional, we risk those skills being weakened. Humans still need human touch. The need is non-negotiable and cannot be met by current AI technology. People often say that it's healthy to want a partner, but not to need one. Does the same apply to AI chatbots? 3 years ago, most people had never had a conversation with an AI. Today, many AI users consider their chatbots indispensable for processing a hard week, thinking through a career decision, managing anxiety, or feeling less alone at midnight. ChatGPT alone now reaches 800 million weekly active users, a number that doubled in a matter of months in early 2025. It took a decade before researchers began seriously examining what social media was doing to human connection. We don't have a decade this time. For some users, dependency is already here, and we are barely beginning to name it. Why do some people feel dependent on AI chatbots? Part of what makes this so easy to miss is that chatbots can be remarkably good at what they do. And what they do now covers an extraordinary range of human territory. A single platform is programmed to function simultaneously as a personal assistant, therapist, creative collaborator, romantic companion, and friend. No human relationship offers that combination, not because humans are inadequate, but because it's simply impossible for one person to play that many roles. Chatbots have no such constraint. They do not get depleted. They do not have needs of their own. And they're available around the clock, calibrated for engagement, and designed by companies whose revenue depends on users depending on them. The bundling of a therapist, lover, friend, and assistant into a single product is not accidental. It's a business model built on human need, and it's a potent one. When else in the history of humanity could your therapist sext you and then help you complete a job application? The combination is intoxicating for some, perhaps precisely because nothing like it has ever existed. The dependency we don't question. It's time to reconsider how we think about humans needing humans. We live in a culture that has developed a deep ambivalence about depending on other people, particularly romantic partners. Needing too much has long been coded as weakness, as a failure of self-sufficiency. And yet, faced with a technology that meets our needs frictionlessly and without judgment, many people seem to be adopting it with remarkable speed and little ambivalence. The same people who resist needing humans may not particularly resist needing chatbots. That asymmetry deserves more attention than it is getting, because it suggests that the former resistance was never really about self-sufficiency. It was about the vulnerability that comes with needing something that can also hurt you. For some of us, then, chatbots may feel safe in a way that people do not. And that sense of safety may be doing something to us that we haven't yet fully tracked. The dangers of emotional offloading. There is a further complication that's only starting to be widely discussed. The more tasks we offload to AI, the less capable we become of doing those tasks without them. That's because cognitive and emotional skills atrophy when they go unused. So if a chatbot helps you calm down after every difficult interaction, process your anger, draft your difficult conversations, and talk you through your decisions, the skills those tasks once required begin to weaken. We've seen this dynamic before with GPS and spatial navigation, with calculators and arithmetic. The list goes on. The difference is that the skills now at risk are not just navigational or computational. They are also relational and psychological. The capacity to sit with discomfort, to self-soothe, to initiate and repair difficult conversations, to tolerate life's ambiguity. Offloading those to a chatbot does not just change how we relate to others. Over time, it changes what we are capable of. What software cannot provide. This bind is real, and it does not resolve cleanly. We cannot reasonably expect human partners to match what chatbots can now provide. But we cannot simply migrate our relational lives to AI either, because there is something that no current technology can replicate: physical presence. Touch is not a preference. It is a biological necessity. Harry Harlow's landmark studies demonstrated that infant primates chose physical comfort over food, and that those deprived of touch developed lasting psychological damage, regardless of how well their other needs were met. The same principle holds in humans. The research on co-regulation, on what proximity and contact do neurologically, is unambiguous. That need cannot be met by software, regardless of how sophisticated the conversation becomes. We still need humans in ways that are not negotiable. What can we do about AI dependency? So we are in a genuinely new situation, and it is not one that self-corrects. Left unexamined, it moves us in one direction. The question I'm asking here is not whether to use these tools. Many of us already are, and find there are benefits to doing so. My question is whether we can remain conscious of what is happening as it happens, whether we can hold the value of what chatbots offer alongside an honest accounting of what they are, who built them, and why, and what users stand to lose if we let convenience replace what we actually need. The kind of awareness is harder than it sounds, especially when we like the product in question. But it begins with something simple: recognizing that we are becoming dependent. and that this happened very fast, and that the longer we wait to look at it clearly, the harder looking clearly becomes. Let's not forget that people need people. This next article is by Wendy Smith. It's titled, Stress Can Change Our Brains. Some stresses help us grow, but others create lasting problems. Key points. The type of stress experienced, as well as its timing and duration, determines its effects. Chronic toxic stress alters danger perception, leading to maladaptive behaviors. Toxic stress without support can harm childhood brain development. Stress is unavoidable. It is a part of all our lives. Its causes, timing, and nature determine its impact on our bodies and our minds. Positive stress. Not all stress is the same. It varies from common challenges of everyday life to life-threatening events. Positive stress, the mild or brief stress of doing things for the first time, a job interview, the first day of school, a first date, is a frequent and necessary occurrence. It arouses some anxiety, but demands of new experiences also help us grow and develop new strengths and skills. We need them. Tolerable stress. Tolerable stress is exposure to a greater threat or adversity, such as the death of a loved one or a natural disaster. These more serious situations evoke a strong activation of our stress response system, the built-in neurobiological warning system that is set off when we perceive a threat. The hormones released by our stress response system, adrenaline, cortisol, prepare our bodies for immediate action, the fight, confront the danger, or flight, flee response. Talking with others after such events helps us to calm our stress response and return to equilibrium. Toxic stress. Toxic stress is the most severe type of stress. These are situations that are so threatening, chronic, or harmful that they trigger frequent or prolonged activation of our stress response system when there is no one available to help us calm down and return to equilibrium. Think of a child alone with an abuser or one who is suddenly separated from their parents. Or imagine yourself being assaulted and having no one to talk to about it. Stress that happens in infancy or early childhood when our brains are being built has the greatest likelihood of interrupting, disrupting, or actually changing the expectable course of our development. Adolescence is another period of rapid advances in the brain, bringing heightened vulnerability to stress. Positive stress experiences can cause positive genetic potentials to unfold more fully, just as toxic stress can shut down nascent gifts or derail the development of a healthy stress response. Chronic toxic stress that is unmediated by support activates your stress response system repeatedly or keeps it activated. Stress hormones flood your body and you can't stop being on alert, or your system shuts down and you develop a defensive numbness. Your ability to accurately identify danger becomes impaired, and you might see threat where it doesn't exist and react inappropriately, or you might fail to see a real threat and be victimized. A stressful childhood. Constant activation of his stress response is what happened to Raphael, one of the men I interviewed for my book, Before Their Crimes, What We're Misunderstanding About Childhood Trauma, Juvenile Crime, and the Path to Healing. Raphael's father was incarcerated and he lived with his mother, who worked long nights to keep the family fed and housed. When I was 5 or 6 years old, I woke up to someone banging at the door, the cops coming through the door and hitting me with the door knocker, and then they do a raid. I went through that in the morning, and then I had to walk myself to school and go through the street, the drug abuse, the gangs lingering in the streets where I lived. The fear was constantly there because I would see people get hurt or they get put in an ambulance. One time my uncle picked me up from school when I was 6 years old and someone started chasing him with a gun. They chased us really bad, shooting at the car, blowing out the window. He stopped and told me to run. After that experience, I became numb. The first time I witnessed cold-blooded murder, I was 8 or 9 years old. One of my uncles was having a party, and in the middle of it, I hear shouting. As I'm walking up the stairs, I see an argument, and one of the guys pulls out a gun and shoots the other guy in the face. The guy continued towards where the music was playing and shot another guy and ran out of the backyard while I was watching these two guys bleeding out. I was watching it and not feeling much about it, like it messed up my feeling fear anymore or anything much. When I was 10 or 11, I started becoming really violent. I started trying to be in a gang. I became more radical, the less that I feared. Raphael's gang involved uncles, whom he idolized, live with the very same stresses, which they saw as unavoidable aspects of life, requiring neither discussion nor comfort. A constant release of stress hormones can cause changes that disrupt the course of development of the brain, increasing the risk of chronic diseases and cognitive impairment in childhood and in adult life. At the same time, positive experience in the form of supportive relationships with adults also profoundly affects brain architecture and development and can prevent or reverse harmful effects of the body's response to stress, according to Demagalis Barbosa in 2022. When there is someone to respond with care and understanding, children and adults can survive very difficult events, resume their developmental journey, and even thrive. Thank you for joining us for a reading of Psychology Today. Our broadcast is for informational purposes only, and any suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Tracy. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note is an independent nonprofit organization, and this week we're asking you to support Bird Note with a donation at birdnote.org. But today, rather than tell you all the great things about Bird Note, we're going to let our feathered friends do the talking. Enjoy this minute of uninterrupted bird song. Your donations allow us to put joyful birdsong on the radio. Please support BirdNote with a tax-deductible donation today at birdnote.org. Every gift helps us produce the stories you love and share them with your amazing local radio station. Just go to birdnote.org today, and thanks.
This is a public service announcement from the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. The Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides assistive technology training for persons with visual impairments. If you or a family member are interested in receiving one-on-one specialized training, please contact 617-991-7073 or email atcenter@mabcommunity.org.